Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's an important topic, so I'm going to try and talk about as much as I can, as fast as I can. Okay. So first of all, here's the question. What are we doing here? Not in this conference. But what are Muslims doing in the United States? Well, for a lot of us, we were born here, so kind of just doing our thing. But I think it's actually an important question to ask, not only because there's some Muslims in the world who think that Muslims actually shouldn't live in non-Muslim countries, non-Muslim majority countries. They say the Quran talks about the duty of hijra. Alam takun ardullahi wasi'a, was God's earth not wide? Why didn't you come and do hijra to a Muslim country? But of course, the duty to do hijra is abrogated because after the conquest of Mecca, there was no more requirement to go to do hijra to Medina. And we know Sahih Hadith and Sahih Muslim that the Prophet allowed Bedouin tribes who converted to Islam to go back and continue to live in the areas they'd been living in before. So this idea of having to do hijra to a Muslim country, I don't think that's actually justified. And second, the general position of Muslim scholars, the vast majority position, has been that Muslims are allowed to live in majority non-Muslim lands or in outside the abode of Islam. They're allowed to live there, provided they're doing some maslaha shar'iyya. They're promoting or pursuing some legitimate good, And those legitimate good things like trade, teaching people about Islam. And when I think about what am I doing here in America? What are Muslims doing in America? I think about this idea of helping people understand Islam, of promoting truth, and helping God's word be elevated. But also, there's something even, probably not more important than that ontologically, but I think more pressing, more important to its immediate need, which is to help prevent, a global civilizational conflagration. The United States has been prosecuting this war on terror for basically war on Islam for some 15 years now. And it's really the duty of American Muslims to be here and try and argue against this, to be part of the argument against this, try to argue against vilification of Islam, vilification of Muslims, to try and make people understand that the rights of Muslims both in the United States and elsewhere need to be taken seriously. They need to be accorded the same treatment, same rights as Christians or other individuals. So this is a very important task. I mean, this is really, our presence here is important, not only to help our country's policies, but also to provide example for other of a lifestyle in this country that's under severe attack. That Muslims, people who care about modesty, who care about family, who care about sexual control, who care about chastity, who care about honoring God. In a lot of parts of the society, that is not these ideas are not prized. In fact, they're kind of mocked. And so we have to be here to stand up for the ideals as well. I think one of the interesting cases, I like this, I wish I could read more about this. I don't think there's that much information in the Islamic tradition, but the Prophet, alayhi salam, he allowed certain Muslims to go back to Mecca even before the conquest of Mecca. He allowed his uncle Abbas to go back to visit, and he allowed his son-in-law, Abu al-As ibn Rabi'ah, to go back. And one of the reasons he allowed him to go back is he could help teach people about Islam. He could help teach people about Islam. This idea of teaching people about Islam, even if they're enemies of their religion, is valued by in the Sunnah of the Prophet. When we talk about the Prophet's, when we try and think about how we deal with non-Muslims, either individuals or organizations, to what extent we can cooperate with them, how do we work together, what are the rules, what are the red lines, what are the limits, what are the ethics, we turn to the normal sources, the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet, for guidelines. And what I find fascinating about the Prophet's Sunnah, alayhi salam, is not necessarily the principles. I mean, he has clear principles. But when it comes to dealing with non-Muslims, what fascinates me is the intelligence. He's a very smart person. He's an extremely sophisticated three-dimensional thinker, four-dimensional thinker in terms of time. And what I notice about Muslims, probably myself included, is that we are extremely naive and extremely unsophisticated about how we approach these questions. And so when we look at the Sunnah of the Prophet, I think the thing we need to appreciate most is how to really look at every situation differently and think, what's at stake here? You know, not to have some simple black and white test, non-Muslims can't work with them, gay person can't work with them, you know, things like that. No, but to think, what is really going on here? Well, how do I balance the potential gains and benefits? And just some examples from the Sunnah of the Prophet. We all know the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, the Prophet, the Quraysh did not want to write down Muhammad Rasulullah. They said, we don't believe you're the messenger of God. He said, that's fine. Say Muhammad ibn Abdullah. He said, that's fine, take it out. Take another situation to contrast this. When, toward the end of his career, Musaylimah, the false claimant of prophecy from Central Arabia, who had actually a large army, came to Medina and said, I will join with you, but you have to name me the prophet after you die. Now, the prophet could have said, I could use his army. After I die, who cares? We'll ignore him, forget it, we can fight him. But he met him at the gates of Medina. He said, I won't even give you the stick I'm carrying. I won't even give you the stick I'm carrying. And turned him away. So in one case, he's willing to compromise on a claim about his prophecy. In the other case, he refuses to compromise, even though it means losing tremendous material benefit. Why is that? Because there is a big difference between agreeing not to assert a claim and agreeing to negate it. Think about this. In the case of the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, he said, fine, don't write Muhammad the messenger of God, because these other people don't believe that anyway. He's not saying, I'm not the messenger of God. He's just saying, look, you don't believe it, fine, don't write it down. In the other case, if he were to name Musaylimah a prophet after him, he would be negating his claim to be Khatam al-Nabiyyin, right? The seal of the prophets. So things that on the surface might look similar, when you look at what their consequences are, you see tremendous difference. We need to get used to looking at situations like that. I think this case is fascinating. In Sahih Bukhari, the prophet is walking one night, late at night, with Sauda, his wife. And people see him walking in the dark. And he says, this is Sauda with me. Is he doing anything wrong? No, he's not doing anything wrong. But he understands the potential perception, and he wants to clear that up. This is an interesting lesson. We have to think, how are our actions perceived? Not just what do we intend, not just are we doing something right or wrong, how are things perceived? It doesn't mean we always give in to perception, because if a bunch of idiots think of something's wrong and we know it's right, maybe we have to stand up for what's right and teach people a lesson. But we have to think, what are the potential perceptions here? Is it worth not clarifying this potential misunderstanding? Another good example, in the Sirah of Ibn Ishaq, which is unreliable, but the story is fairly well accepted, when a delegation of Christians from Najran, the city of Najran, which is now right on the border between Saudi Arabia and Yemen, came to Medina, the Prophet allowed them to pray in the mosque. They allowed them to pray, do their Christian prayers in the mosque of Medina. But he did not allow Muslims to wear the symbols of other religions. You can't wear a cross, you can't wear, let's say, a certain belt that a Christian wears or a certain color hat that a Christian would wear. You can't do this. So he allows people to perform their religious obligations because there's no question about validating that. The Quran is clear, the Sunnah is clear about criticizing the practices of other religious traditions. Clear about what their problems are. But he does not allow Muslims to make ambiguous the markers on their body. Muslims can't be ambiguous about who they are. They have to make it clear to other people and to themselves that they are a distinct ummah, they are a distinct community. Because if you don't do that, you start blending in and disappearing. If you start giving up your identity markers and not thinking what signs these identity markers send to other people, your community solidarity dissolves. Think of, and here's examples of seeking aid of non-Muslims in the life of the Prophet. And you see, again, tremendous sophistication. So the Prophet, during his extended time of war with the Meccans and their allies, cultivated non-Muslim allies. So the Meccans, the Prophet, and the Muslims in Mecca had allies who were mushrikun, who were polytheists. Some of them were actually secret allies. So one of the parties that was actually with the Meccan army at the Battle of Uhud, Ma'bad of the Khuza'a tribe, one of the leaders of the Khuza'a tribe, he was actually fighting on the Meccan side. But after the battle, remember the Muslims were almost effectively defeated in the battle. If the Quraysh had attacked, the Quraysh and their allies had attacked the Muslims, instead of stopping the battle, they could have defeated them completely. But Ma'bad of the Khuza'a tribe convinces the Quraysh leaders not to engage in a second attack. So this alliance, even a secret alliance he had cultivated with a polytheist Arab, ended up being incredibly important. Before the Battle of Hunain, toward the end of the war with the Meccans, or now not with the Meccans anymore, with the people of Ta'if, the leaders of Ta'if, the Prophet, they needed more armor and weapons. And so he actually borrowed armor and weapons from Safwan bin Umayyah, who was one of the remaining mushrikun of Mecca, a leading mushrik of Mecca. And in another, this is a hadith in Sahih Bukhari and in Abu Dawood, that later on, Safwan bin Umayyah would say, before, when I was a polytheist, the Prophet of God was the most hated person to me. But because he treated me so fairly and so justly, he became the most beloved person to me after he became Muslim. This case I find fascinating. It's in Sahih Muslim. The Muslim army sets out on campaign. And in fact, they need more soldiers. And this man comes up on his camel who's actually a fearsome warrior. He's very respected, and but he's not Muslim. And he says, I want to go fight with you because I want to basically get spoils of war and glory. And the Prophet says to him, we do not seek aid from mushrikeen. We don't seek aid the polytheists. The man comes back again and says, let me go with you. Let me fight. He says, no. Let me go with you. Let me fight. He says, no. Finally, he becomes Muslim so that he can go. So it's very interesting. If the Prophet had immediately said, sure, come along with us, he wouldn't have become Muslim. Because he didn't allow him to join, the man became Muslim so that he could join in the campaign. So again, this is, you know, the Prophet clearly takes the aid of non-Muslims. But in this case, he's telling the guy, we don't want the help of non-Muslims. This actually leads the person to conversion. So this is tremendous sophistication in thinking about these issues. And this is something that I was actually, Imam Suhaib Webb was telling me about just yesterday or 2 days ago, and I was fascinated by it. Also, the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, the Prophet is talking about what he's going to agree with the Meccans. Remember, the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, the Muslims set out to do Umrah. And they stop and they agree with, they meet with the Meccans, the Quraysh, and they agree. They will not do the pilgrimage this year, they will do it next year, and they will have a 10-year peace. And a lot of the Muslims, including Umar ibn al-Khattab, are very confused by this agreement. They see this as a compromise that's unacceptable, as a compromise to the mushrikun. And the Prophet says, لَا يَسْأَلُونِي خُطَّةً يُعَذَّمُونَ فِيهَا حُرُمَاتَ اللَّهِ إِلَّا أَعْطَيْتُهُمْ إِيَّاهَا. They will not ask me, the Quraysh will not ask me for anything, any matter, by which they glorify those things revered by God, except that I will agree to that issue. What does that mean? If they anything they want from me that leads to the glorification of God, or that isn't itself an act of worship of God, I will agree to. I will agree to. And then I was reading about this in the Mukhtasar Zad al-Ma'ad. So Ibn al-Jawzi. No, Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyah. He wrote this famous book, Zad al-Mi'ad, about the seerah of the Prophet. Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab did a commentary on this. Now, I'm using Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab because if you like ibn Abdul Wahhab, then you'll like what I'm going to say. If you don't like ibn Abdul Wahhab, you're getting it from the most conservative person, so there's no way you can say it's not legitimate. It's like, you know, only Nixon can go to China, or it's like some Republican praising Barack Obama. You have to take it seriously, right? He says, ibn Abdul Wahhab says regarding this, Al-Mushrikeen wa Ahl al-Fujur إذا طلبوا أمرا يعظمون به حرمة من حرمات الله أجيبوا إليه وإن منعوا غيره. The polytheists and people, sinful people, if they ask for something by which they will glorify something revered by God, that request should be accepted. Even if those people prevent you from doing other things to glorify God. The Quraysh did not allow the Muslims to perform the pilgrimage that year. So even they prevented the Muslims from doing the pilgrimage, the Prophet still agreed to the treaty because this treaty was going to promote, eventually, the glorification of God and the worship of God. And so what is the Ibn Abdul Wahhab continue to say? So these people, sinners and polytheists, should be supported and aided in those things that glorify the veneration of God, but they should not be aided in their disbelief or in their iniquitous behavior. So فَمَنْ أَلْتَمَسَ الْمُعَاوَنَ عَلَى مَحْبُوبٍ لِلَّهِ تَعَالَى أُجِيبُ إِلَى ذَلَكَ كَائِنًا مَنْ كَانَ. So if somebody seeks aid in regards to something that is beloved to God, you should accept and give that person aid, regardless of who they are. Important condition. مَا لَمْ يَتَرَتَّبْ عَلَى ذَلِكَ الْمَحْبُوبُ مَبْغُودٌ لِلَّهِ أَعْظَمُ مِنْهُ. So if someone seeks aid in a matter that is beloved to God, you should accept to give them that, you should give them that aid, regardless of who they are. As long as something that is disliked by God, that is greater than that thing liked by God, is not dependent on that aid. So imagine this, you know, Dr. Jasser is, let's say he's actually a horrible, evil monster, unbelieving sorcerer or something like that, like Jafar in the Aladdin, okay? And he says, I would like a sandwich. I would like you to give me a pen so that I can write something. But I know he's actually going to take that pen and stab some innocent person in the head. I don't know why I'm victimizing you like this. But let's say a pen is beloved to God. Writing is beloved to God. Learning is beloved to God. But then I know that that what he's going to do with this is actually much worse than the thing that is beloved to God in this case. This is something important to think about. Because, as I said with the case of the Prophet, it asks us to weigh things, weigh goods and evils, weigh harms and benefits. That's something that you can't have a rule for. Sometimes I think Muslims, you know, we're used to thinking halal, haram, black, white. Rules are really good for certain things in life. They're really good for knowing, you know, do I need to do wudu or not? Can I eat this food or not? Do I have to pay the zakat or not? Rules, black and white rules, are not good for political decisions. Where's Nasser? We in the David Lubin's class in Georgetown Law, he was talking about this. The problem of there's this some Doctor Who story where there are these two people and they like creatures and they come to an impasse and neither of them will move aside. Has anyone ever read this Doctor Who story? Not Doctor Who, Dr. Seuss. You know, there's like these, they're called like imps or something. And they end up building the whole city over them because neither of them will move aside. That's the kind of, that law can't solve these problems. Politics solve these problems. And politics is about weighing interests. What are harms and benefits? Muslims need to think about this. And we need to think. We need allies in this country. The truth, despite the truth is evident, the truth needs allies. We need allies so that we can practice our religion freely. which is one of the aims of Islam. And we need religion so that we can continue to be shuhada lil qist. Qawamuna lillah shuhada lil qist. So that we can stand for God and be witnesses for truth in this country. We need allies. So the question is, our allies don't share our beliefs. Our allies don't share some of our social values or our family values. Does that mean we can't work with them? The Prophet worked with non-Muslims, the Prophet worked with polytheists, the Prophet worked with Christians, the Prophet worked with Jews, with whose belief he disagreed fundamentally, right? So we need to ask ourselves, if let's say there's a LGBT organization that supports Muslim rights, so let's say Muslim rights to Sharia marriage contracts, when we work with them and say we want to support your right to have gay marriage contracts, we don't agree with homosexuality as a lifestyle, but we actually want the same thing, which is we want to have definitions of marriage in this country that are legally protected, that are not controlled by Christian Western European bias about polygamy or homosexuality or anything like that. So we actually want the same end. And we're not promoting their lifestyle, but they're going to do their lifestyle anyway. It's legal in this country. We're not promoting it. We are actually after a very specific objective, which facilitates our best interests and facilitates their best interests. We need to think, what are the benefits and the potential harms here? When this is an issue which, I'm almost done, don't worry, but this is an issue which, you know, I talk about a lot. Anyone's heard of this MLI, Muslim Leadership Initiative? This is an organization set up by this guy, Abdullah Antepli. He's a Muslim chaplain at Duke, and this organization, Shalom Hartman Institute in Israel, where young Muslims go to Israel to learn about Zionism and Judaism. I would love to learn about Judaism and Zionism. That's great. You can do that anywhere in this country. You can do that in Europe. You can do that in Switzerland or Japan or wherever. But when you go to Israel on the dime of an Israeli institution, you're violating the boycott, divest, sanction movement, which is the BDS movement, which has been supported by and asked for by Palestinian civil society, and which is tremendously successful and supported by lots of non-Muslims, Christians and Jews and atheists and rock stars and non-rock stars, et cetera, et cetera. So if Muslims, we might think, oh, the Prophet talked to his enemies. It's good to engage in dialogue. That's true. But then look at what the negative consequences are. More and more people are taking a stand against the apartheid policies of the Israeli government. And who's going to undermine the solidarity against those policies? Young Muslims. You start looking at what are the consequences of that? What are the consequences if Muslims start thinking about people can violate solidarity because it seems a good idea to them? They don't think, what are the consequences of this? What does it mean if Muslims start breaking ranks on any issue, even agreed upon issues, because certain people think it's a good idea or beneficial to them? So my last word would be, think about this idea of weighing harms and interests. Think not only in three dimensions, think four dimensions down the road. What are the potential consequences of your decisions? Jazakum Allah khair.
We're going to start with the first question specifically sent to Dr. Brown. So if you want to address it.
Oh, this is the worst kind of question. Someone's trying to get me in whatever, hot water. But it's a good question, and I'll offer my thoughts. And, you know, if I'm wrong, then not the end of the world, I guess. Question is, our message is often approached by the Ahmadiyya community who wants to work together for common goals, but they want us to do this as a unified Muslim group, which would cause problems since their creed is different from ours. How should we work with them? It's an excellent question, and actually phrased in a very perceptive way. Here's the way I would approach it, which is, what is the objective here? Okay, so an Ahmadi community approaches the mosque, and they say, we want to work together on, I don't know, building houses for the homeless. Okay, that's great. I mean, if Christians or Jews or atheists or anybody approached us and said, we want to build houses for homeless, we'd say, okay, fine, that's great. The aim here is to do good deeds. And there's no other element there. There's no other aspect. I would have no problem with that. But they want to do it as a unified Muslim group. So this right away would raise flags to me, because this really isn't about doing good deeds. This is about making a statement about that Ahmadis are Muslims. And that's precisely the issue of dispute, right? If people want to have that discussion, let's have that discussion. Let's not disguise it and try and slip it into a charity and a charitable endeavor. So that's, I think it's, you know, first, you know, one of the important things to do is to see things for what they are and say, look, charity is great. If you want to do charity together, that's terrific. I'm happy to do it. But, you know, let's not pretend that there's not real disagreement about whether or not Muslims consider you, to the Ahmadi community, to be Muslims or a deviant sect. And the fact is that there are, you know, there's some disagreement on it, but there's a, you know, large, perhaps vast majority opinion amongst Muslim scholars is that certainly Qadiani Ahmadis are not Muslims. And even if let's say I don't agree with that, I'm just hypothetically saying that, it would be irresponsible for me as a mosque leader to neglect or to ignore the fact that a huge number of scholars do think that, and probably a lot of people in my mosque community think that. So it's not really my place to make a decision that is still under tremendous debate, on an issue that's still under tremendous debate. That's something that has to be discussed as a community. You know, it can't be, again, sort of snuck in through its supposedly charitable endeavor. By the way, I mean, it's also important to remember, one of the reasons that the Ahmadi issue is so sensitive, especially among South Asians, is because it was originally political. Right, so I mean, obviously, Ahmadis don't believe this, but there is real. I mean, I think there's significant evidence, and there's certainly a very clear perception among South Asian Muslims that the Ahmadi community was sort of a fifth column, encouraged, to say the least, encouraged by British colonial presence. And so this is, even if that's not true, let's say that's not true, the perception is so strong that, again, it would be irresponsible as a mosque leader to simply ignore that and say that we're going to go into to do a partnership on charitable actions. So you know, you have to take consideration for what the feelings of your congregation are or of the constituency. And this is something that, I mean, I'm not actually sure about. I've been trying to find out the answer. If you look at kind of Ahmadi websites, you know, like 10 things about Ahmadis that people say are not true. One of the things it'll say is, you know, there's this claim that Ahmadis don't think that non-Ahmadis are really Muslims. And they say this is, the website will say that's not true. But I've actually heard reports from members, you know, spokespeople in the Ahmadi community that they might not consider non-Ahmadis to be real Muslims. I don't know what the, actually, I want to say very clearly, I do not know what the correct answer is. I don't know what the correct answer is. I wouldn't spread false information. It may be that it's a myth that Ahmadis actually do view other Muslims as full Muslims, or they may not. My point is, there's so many unanswered questions. These issues have to be discussed. And by the way, I don't care if Ahmadis don't think that I'm a real Muslim. I mean, even if that's the truth, I still don't care if they say they want to do charitable work with me. That's fine. Like, I don't think Aga Khan Ismaili, I don't think they're Muslims. But if they come and say we want to do some kind of charitable project together or some kind of project, I'm happy to do that. But again, you have to separate that from this attempt to kind of extract a statement out of you about unity when your community is simply not ready to make that statement. It's something that still has to be discussed. So be very careful. See things as they are. These questions are so big, I don't think I have enough time to think about them. I mean, I'll just try my best. First one is, how do we promote interfaith initiatives on college campuses without normalizing? For example, as an MSA leader, I am hesitant to work with the Halal House because of their position in relationship to Palestine-Israel conflict. Second question, what is the responsibility of the Muslim youth who are attracted by homosexual mosques or Muslims? How can we make it clear that homosexuality is prohibited in Islam? I've never been attracted to a mosque. That must be some other inclination, but I'm just joking. It's clear questions. I mean, again, I would, and I think these really are, these are big issues that people especially face on campus, Muslims face on campus. You know, if you're a Muslim MSA, involved in MSA, you will inevitably be approached by let's say Hillel, or to do an event, a common event. When it comes to non-Muslim communities, I think that, you know, it's actually a bit, you know, the situation's a bit easier to understand. They're clearly a different religion. They clearly have different political views. And so you're not, you know, you're at least, you're not confusing what Islam is. There's not a problem of potentially making ambiguous the Muslim position towards Islamic belief. But there is, of course, the problem of political normalization, that by working with them, they will create the image that you don't really care about, let's say, Israel-Palestine issue or other issues of political justice. So, you know, I think that the easiest thing to do is just to be very clear about things. Say, look, you know, let's say Hillel wants to do an event about the problems of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in America. That's great. You know, we can do that. But then let's make absolutely clear that this is not about Israel-Palestine issue. Like, just make this absolutely clear. And in fact, that should even be announced at the event. This is not about the Israel-Palestine issue. That's a separate issue. You know, and what is the aim? What is the objective of the other group? If the objective of the other group is really to deal with issues of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia as a common problem or as a similarly related phenomena, then that's fine. But if there's an attempt to kind of make things ambiguous, if, let's say, the Hillel House doesn't want to make an announcement about Israel-Palestine, let's say they don't want to give the MSA a chance to make a statement about Israel-Palestine, if they don't want to make things clear, then you can tell what their aim is. They're trying to use the ambiguity. If they're fine with making things clear, then I don't see as much of a problem of working together if there's a common cause. So again, try and make things explicit, and if you get resistance on that, then that's the message, you know? The issue of, like, let's say, LGBT Muslim groups, this is much harder to deal with, because here you're talking about something inside the Muslim community. And you're also dealing, at least especially on campus, with real questions that the university might have about whether or not the Muslim student organization is actually meeting the needs of the Muslim student body. You know, with the university, they don't care. I mean, the university, in theory, they're not going to decide if being gay is okay in Islam. That's not their problem. All they know is there are people who say they're Muslim, who say they want to be involved in MSA, and the MSA is not listening to them. That becomes an additional problem. I think if there's an issue of like a, let's say, LGBTQ student group or Muslim LGBTQ Muslim group approaching the MSA, I would try and say, you know, what is the objective here? Are they trying to do dialogue? Are they trying to do, you know, let's say, make sandwiches for poor people or something? My guess is probably it's simply a matter of dialogue and discussion. And here, that has no objective. I mean, dialogue has no objective except understanding. And if your position is, I don't agree with your lifestyle choices, then dialogue can only be seen as my, you know, increasing or desire to be potentially supportive of your choices. If they want to get together to make sandwiches for poor people, then there's actually some objective. There's some fruit out there that you're aiming for. And if an LGBTQ Muslim group came and said, we want to have, you know, a meeting with MSA or do dialogue with MSA, what I would say is, look, I think it's important for you to talk to other Muslims about your views, and they can hear your views and you can hear their views, but this doesn't have to be done at an institutional level. This can be done at a private level. Just, you know, why don't you go talk to Muslims together? If your interest is dialogue, then why does this have to be formally approved by the MSA or an organization? And if people are okay with that, then their aim is really just to talk. But if they're looking for that institutional approval, then again, that's a political objective, and you don't want to be sucked into that.
Okay. This question is about, you mentioned working with LGBT communities on marriage rights. Can you please elaborate on how this is not promoting a free lifestyle of marriage regarding to marriage? Basically, how is this not promoting homosexuality? I mean, I think it's easy, which is that marriage is, the civil marriage agreement status or contract has nothing to do with what people do. I mean, if you're saying, I want to have marriage in America be as free of Western European Christian bias as possible. So instead of saying, you know, this marriage must be between one man and one woman, I want to just say, this is an agreement between X and Y about sharing property and sharing access to insurance and things like that. You know, that's I want that as a Muslim, because that's not, by the way, it's just important to remember, in the US and in the UK and the British Empire, up until the 1930s and 40s, Muslim marriages were not valid, period. because they were potentially polygamous. Not even if polygamous, just because they were potentially polygamous. Don't ever forget that polygamy is far much of a bête noire, far more of a demon in the mind of Western civilization than homosexuality. Polygamy is far worse in the Western mind than homosexuality. That's the Republican Party was founded for to fight two things: slavery and polygamy. Don't forget that. Muslims are, we tend to think, oh, we're like Abrahamic brothers with Christians and Jews, and we're all together against this sort of evil liberal lifestyle of other people. Muslim marriage is just as monstrous to conservative Christians as gay marriage is. It is just as monstrous. Don't ever forget that. We are a monster to them. And the arguments that were made against gay marriage in the Supreme Court case of Obergefell, if you took out gay marriage and put in Muslim marriage, the same exact argument would apply. Don't forget that. So when I say I want a marriage contract that does not import Western European Christian ideas of marriage, I want something that is as broad, as nondescript as possible, that's a real concern I have as a Muslim. Remember, if these Sharia bills get passed, my marriage to my wife, my Sharia marriage contract is not going to be legally valid. She's not going to be able to go and get her dowry from me, God forbid, if I decide to do things like that, right? So this is very important to keep in mind. And if gay people want the same thing, which is a marriage contract that doesn't say one man and one woman, we happen to want the same thing. They can still have a relationship. They can go and live together and do whatever they do. They're not going to listen to my opinion about that. And I'm going to tell them, I don't agree with the way you live, but we want the same objective. And I'm not promoting their lifestyle. I'm promoting a type of marriage that we both want.
Jazakallah khairan. Thank you so much. Let's give our speakers another round of applause. And thank you for being a great audience.